turned on. Okay? Great. Okay. Yes, so review of last time. All right. Remember that we wanted to calculate the set of all jets of functions that do that. This is the convex set gamma. One of the results from last time was that we could calculate this by an algorithm. And I want to remind you of the algorithm. So the algorithm is that we define gamma L. And the way we do it is that, well, right now let's take X in E. That's for expository purposes. Okay. So to make the problem easier to describe, we defined gamma 0, which was some trivial thing defined simply by the information available only at the point, at the single point X, and ignoring everything else. And so this is the set of all P in our vector space of polynomials, such that P of X, this one single point, is what it's supposed to be, and its derivatives are bounded by what we already know by definition. So that's our start, but then messages start getting passed from one point to another, and therefore gamma L plus 1 of XM was defined inductively to be the set of all P in gamma L of XM, such that for all Y in E, there exists a P prime in the gamma L, which has been previously defined, of YM, such that P and P prime are close enough together, namely that. Okay? Let's see. The last time I spoke, we defined these guys. These are convex sets in script P. They contain the gamma, but they're getting smaller as L gets bigger. And the theorem is for L equals some constant depending only on which function space we're in, we have the inclusions that, that the actual gamma that we want is contained in gamma L star. That's trivial. But we have also that X gamma L of XM contains gamma L star, well, let's put it this way, gamma X star of XM is contained in gamma X CM. And that's the serious theorem. Okay, so last time I claimed that this was true. And I also claimed that once you know how to prove this, you know how to prove everything. And thank you, E is finite. Oops. Yes. Finite. Sorry. So, yes it is. So, thank you. So there are supposed to be two things that I will accomplish by 12:30. One is that I will explain something about this, and the other is that I will say something about infinity. Okay? As I look out at the audience, I think I see enough frowns and scowls that I would like to just to backtrack and to ask. So am I right? People don't really quite remember this. It appeared in the last lecture, but people don't quite remember, and a little review would be a good idea. Little review is always a good idea. Okay, okay, okay.
I don't know from what page it was proven that actually that was, but I mean, the claim was that it was the government, but of course it was.
Oh. I'm sorry. I take back about, I mean, some of us remember extremely well. This is the correct statement. Yes. Okay. So let me just remind you of the motivations for these things. Okay. So, all right, we would like to interpolate, we would like to find interpolants capital F that agree with F to some accuracy. That's the real problem. But for expository purposes, I'm just going to restrict attention to the question of matching little f perfectly on the set E. The set E is finite, sorry about that. E is a given arbitrarily large finite set in Rn. Now, we would like to find interpolants that agree perfectly and whose norms are not too big. How much freedom of action do we have in picking such a thing? And one of the crucial measures in deciding that is this set gamma. So we fix one particular point and we ask, what can we say about the jet of an interpolant F that does this, if any exist? Okay, what can we say about the jet of such an interpolant at one point? And we define the gamma to consist of all the jets at this one given point of all possible interpolants that do the job. Remember I mentioned the car trip, right? I get in my car and I know that my car is incapable of accelerating more than a certain rate, and so the C2 norm is bounded by some M. On the other hand, I observe where I am. I think I said before approximately. Now let's say I observe exactly where I am at 50 different times. And so my set E contains 50 different times, and my position is exactly known at 50 different times. And then I ask, okay, what can I say about my position, my velocity, and my acceleration somewhere in the course of the trip? So this time X needn't be one of the points at which I knew my position exactly. But it might be, and for expository purposes, I'm going to say, okay, at one of these 50 times at which I measured my position perfectly, what is my velocity? What might my velocity be, given the information that I know? The information that I know is that at 50 different times I measured the position, and I know that the acceleration is at most whatever my old car can do. Okay? And so this gamma measures that. Remember, gamma might be empty. For example, I get on my car, I get in my car, and I would like to, here I am in Toronto, I would like to drive to Montreal, and I'd like to get there in 15 minutes. Well, I'm sorry, I can't do that given the capabilities of my car. This, given my M, you know, I have a car, not a spaceship, and so I can't do that, and gamma will then be the empty set. So, all right, do people remember and feel comfortable with what gamma is? Okay. All right, now remember, the plan to calculate the gamma is that we're going to define for each x in E, we're going to define a gamma sub L of xm. And this gamma sub L is a convex set which contains the gamma that we want to understand, but is perhaps too big. But as L grows, it is going to get smaller. And the theorem then says that we can take L to be a large enough universal constant, depending only on which function space we're working in, and not on the particular interpolation problem we're solving. Okay? And the claim is then, well, the gamma is going to be contained in this gamma L star just because we have constructed the gamma L's to be shrinking but too big. So here, all right, this one is too big. But if L star is large enough, it's not much too big, and this converse inequality is true, and that says that essentially we've understood the gammas. We've essentially understood the question of what can be the possible jets of function capital F at a given point that that agree with the data little f exactly, and whose CM norm is more or less of the, I mean, of the order of magnitude at most M. Okay, so that's where we're going. Now, the detailed description of the gamma L's is as follows. First, again, just for expository purposes, we're only taking X here to be in the set E, although for the real problem and for the real, you know, if you look up the paper, you'll see that X can be anywhere. But let's say that X is simply in E, one of the points where we know the value of the function, and we want to know what we can say then about its about the derivatives of an interpolant. Okay, so gamma, to understand gamma 0 of XE, we just look at this one point in E. We have been told that we have an interpolant whose norm is at most something or other, and that agrees with little f on the whole set E. Let's throw out the whole set E, except for this one point at which we're making the observation. What can you say about the jet of a function whose CM norm is at most capital M, and which agrees with little f at one point? That's a trivial question. This is the answer to the trivial question. Okay? And it's obvious that this is a convex subset of script P, and it's obvious that it contains the true gamma, because the jets for the true gamma satisfy not only this stuff, but other conditions, having to do with the fact that maybe there are other points in E. So that starts the induction. Okay? Now we're going to continue the induction. So to continue the induction, let's fix an L, and let's imagine that I've defined all the gamma sub L at all the points Y and E. Okay? Then I'm going to define gamma L plus 1 of XM for all X in E. So that's the induction step to make the gammas well defined. C is a constant that doesn't depend on L. It's just it's the maximum of some binomial coefficients that come from Taylor's theorem, which never in my life have I actually calculated. I usually take it to be 1, but somebody in the audience caught me last time. Nothing to do with that C. Okay, so simply if I have an interpolant and I have two points X and Y, and if P is the jet at X and P prime is the jet at Y, then P and P prime are close together. In fact, they satisfy that, and that's just Taylor's theorem. Okay. And so now now I would like to pass messages back from among the points of E. So which, suppose that I'm given a jet P which belongs to the gamma L. I'd like to decide whether it might possibly be the jet of an interpolant. Okay. Well, if it is the jet of an interpolant, then for every Y and E, I can ask what is the jet of the interpolant of the same interpolant at that other point. And it must be some jet P prime that satisfies these estimates. Furthermore, because it is the jet of an interpolant, by induction hypothesis, the P prime must belong here. So by induction hypothesis, I know that if I make this definition, then this guy is a convex, possibly empty subset of script P, which is guaranteed to contain the true gamma, and which is getting smaller because this guy consists of certain jets in here. Okay? So this is where we were. So again, the gamma measures what the jet can be of an interpolant can be at one given point. We would like to understand it. In order to understand it, we have this inductive process. This is actually the wrong inductive process because it's too expensive. Remember, there's this n squared versus n log n, and really we have to bring in the well-separated pairs decomposition. But never mind. So for the moment, we're not going to worry about efficiency, and we'll work with this. And the claim is that this, if we crank this machine a bounded number of times, if we crank it L star times, we will wind up with something which, well, of course this is true. That's what it was defined to do. Okay? But it will also do that. In other words, we can stop, basically. We've found the essential size and shape of the gamma. Okay? So this is one of the theorems. I would like to try to convince you a little bit that if we can prove this, then we're in good shape to prove all of the other theorems that I stated about CM. None of the theorems about Sobolev spaces, but all of the theorems I stated about CM for finite sets. Okay? Why? Because what does this say? It says that if I have a jet in something or other that I've constructed, then there is an interpolant. The gamma is the set of jets for which there is an interpolant. And so in order to prove this, especially in order to give a constructive proof of this, I have to construct interpolants. So in order to be able to prove this theorem, I have to have a good way of constructing interpolants. So for every case in which I have not obviously ruled out the existence of an interpolant, we will build an interpolant. Okay? So I hope that that is a reasonable, morally convincing discussion to say that if we can prove this, then we can understand CM for finite sets, CM interpolation problems. Okay? I would propose to stop the review there and start on the proof. Now, I still see some scowls in the audience. Can anyone formulate some question about what is not yet clear? Or should I just gulp and... Yeah. Okay. Well, what I propose to do. So, thank you. Such questions are always welcome. What I propose to do now is to sketch the proof. The full proof is very complicated, but I would like to show you some ideas from the proof. Okay. So that's the next thing that I'll do. All right. All right, so sketch of proof. All right. Well, remember the sketch of the proof of the Whitney extension theorem. There was a Calderon-Zsigmond decomposition. We localized to cubes, and we picked the right cubes. All right. Again, we're going to pick the right cubes and localize, but the description of what the right cubes are will be much more complicated than for Whitney. Okay? So what I would like to do is discuss a little bit a local interpolation problem. So we're going to localize our problem to a cube. So here's the situation. We have a cube Q, and then it's useful to take, let's say, Q star, which is Q dilated by some fixed factor, let's say 3. Okay? And then we're going to have a set E. It's all my sets until I say otherwise. All my sets E are finite. Okay? And E is going to be contained in Q star. And if I look at my original problem and I'm trying to localize it, of course E will have lots of points that are not in 3Q star and I just throw, I mean, that are not in Q star, I will just throw them away in order to localize the problem. Okay? All right. I have also a function F taking that E to the reals. So I'm given such data. So the data are Q. Oh, and there's also there's more. Sorry. Somewhere in here, there is a point X, and this X belongs to E. It might be in Q. I mean, it's somewhere in Q star. It might also be, might be here. Okay. But this is a base point. And furthermore, at this base point, I'm given a jet. So this is simply a polynomial of degree whatever, and I think of it as a jet at x. So my data for the local interpolation problem will be a cube Q, a finite set E, a function F, a, let's see, a point X, a function F, and a jet P. These are my data. Okay? And then I'm going to, then I'm going to describe the notion of a local interpolation problem. So LIP does not stand for Lipschitz, it stands for local interpolation problem. Okay? So LIP of whatever it is, Q, E, X, F, P, is the following problem. Find a function, let's say F, in CM of R, not of Rn, sorry, just of Q star. So we're solving a localized problem such that, first of all, F equals F on E. Secondly, the jet at this base point F is equal to the given P. And thirdly, the norm of F in CM dot of Q is as small as possible up to a factor C, where C is some constant that depends only on little m and little n. That's a local interpolation problem. Furthermore, it would be nice if... I'm sorry, oh yes, what does C... This is the... I measure only the mth derivatives, not any of the derivatives of order lower. Okay, so let's say a polynomial... If I am so lucky that I can find capital F to be a polynomial of low degree that agrees with the data, I will use that. And then this number will be zero, which is certainly as low as it can be. But that's highly unlikely. If I give you some interpolation problem, it's highly unlikely that you can fit a billion points with a third degree polynomial. Okay? This is a local interpolation problem. By the way, let me, in the interests of full disclosure, okay, I am systematically lying to you. I hope to convey the basic idea of the proof, but you should not believe anything I say. Nothing is to be taken literally. What I hope is that at the end of the lecture, you will come out with a feeling for the spirit of the thing. But if you take anything in particular that I say and you say, and you think to yourself, wait a minute, that's not right, you're probably right. All right, now, okay, so it's clear what a local interpolation problem is? Okay, now, I claim that if I can solve every local interpolation problem, then I can understand how to construct interpolants, and then I can, for example, prove this theorem. Okay? This I take Q, let's say, to be unit cube, and I take X to be some harmless point somewhere. I take X to be one point of E. This problem is almost the same problem I'm solving, except that I'm looking for one particular P. I've given one particular P, but if I can solve that, then I can ask, okay, is there a P such that whatever conditions I came up with are satisfied, and that's not much harder. So if I can solve such problems in a reasonable, constructive way, then I'm in good shape to prove the theorem. I'm sorry, so... Okay, no. No. It's whatever comes out of the proof. I will be happy with any C that depends only on little n and little m. Okay. Okay, so this is a local interpolation problem. Now, all right, now local interpolation problems are either easy or hard or very hard. I'm going to attach to each local interpolation problem a label. Okay, so I want to talk about labels. So first of all, what is a label? Well, first, what does a label do? Then what is a label? And then a little bit more information. So a label is going to, so a label is some simple thing that I either will or will not attach to any given local interpolation problem. And this label is going to tell me how hard I think the problem is. Labels will come ordered. There are not many labels. The number of labels is some simple constant depending on little m and little n. Maybe it's some binomial coefficient. So labels will come ordered. And something that is low in the order is it will label an easy interpolation problem, and a label that is high in the order will label a hard interpolation problem. Maybe I should say what a label is. All right, so let's look. So, labels. So let me introduce, first of all, script M. And this is simply the set of all multi-indices alpha. So this is a multi-index, such that the order of alpha, that is simply alpha 1 plus alpha n, is less than or equal to m minus 1. Remember, we're working in Cm of Rn. And our jets are always, in this discussion, are m minus 1 jets. Okay? All right. So now, a label is simply a subset A contained in contained in script M. Okay? And I'm going to explain how we do it, but we will attach a label or many labels. Well, given a local interpolation problem, which I'll write QEXFP, given a local interpolation problem and a label A, we will decide whether it is allowed to attach label A to the given problem. And that will give us information about how hard we think the problem is. Before I say how we will decide, I'm just going to say that labels come with a total order relation. So I'm just going to write it as less than. So let's say A is less than A prime. And if A is less than A prime, then it means roughly that we think that any problem that carries a label A prime is harder than any problem that carries the label A. Well, but the same problem can carry more than one label. So when I attach a given label, it means that the problem is guaranteed, I hope anyway, that the problem is guaranteed to be no harder than something or other. Okay, so I have two problems with two different labels, and I don't know which one is harder, but I've attached a label to each of them, and the one that carries the easier label has the guaranteed difficulty easier than the one with the harder label. Okay? Let me tell you a little bit about this order. So I'm not going to specify it. It's some glorified lexicographic order. But the one of the most important features of this order is that if A prime is contained in A as a subset, that implies that A is, let's say it's strictly contained, then A is strictly less than A prime. Okay? And an immediate corollary of that is that the whole set script M is minimal and labels the easiest problems. And the whole and the empty set, which is a subset of everything, the empty set is maximal and therefore labels the hardest problems. Okay? We will see trivially that every interpolation problem carries the label of the empty set. But only the most utterly trivial problems carry the label of script M. Okay? Now, in order to solve local interpolation problems, I'm going to proceed by induction on the label with respect to this order. So I claim that we can solve any local interpolation problem that carries the label A. And I'm going to prove that by induction on A. In the base case for the induction, A is the lowest possible thing. It is script M. Therefore, I need to be able to solve all interpolation problems that carry the label script M. But I promise you that such interpolation problems are trivial. Okay? And so, in the base case, we have to solve some trivial interpolation problem. I will actually do it. Of course, I can't do that until I explain what the hell it means to attach a label to a problem. But we will see that it is completely trivial in the base case. Okay? Therefore, the only serious work to do is the induction step. For the induction step, I fix a label A, which is not the most trivial label, so A is not all of script M, and I imagine that I already know how to solve all local interpolation problems which carry a label easier than script A. My problem is then to solve a local interpolation problem that carries exactly the label script A, but no easier label. If I can do that, then by induction on the label A, I can solve any local interpolation problem that carries any label, but in particular at the end of the induction, I can take the label to be the empty set, the maximal label under the order, and I will then be able to solve any local interpolation problem that carries as a label the empty set. But I promised you that every local interpolation problem carries the label of the empty set. Okay? And therefore I will have solved every interpolation problem. So, all right, what do I owe you? I owe you an explanation of what it means to attach a label. I owe you the proof of this little simple remark. I owe you the explanation that for the minimal script M, that the local interpolation problem is trivial. And by far the most serious, I owe you the proof of the induction step. If I can do every interpolation problem labeled by any A prime less than A, then I can do any interpolation problem labeled by A. Okay, that's what I owe you. All right. Okay. So, I will erase such trivia as what we're actually trying to prove and just focus on the Anschauung. Okay. So, in order to, oh, I've just, well done, Charlie, I've just erased what I need. Remember the definition of the gamma. Let me define a closely related set, and that is the sigma. In fact, so let's say sigma of x without an m. This is simply the set of all jets at x of functions f such that the norm of f in CM is, let's say, less than or equal to 1 rather than less than or equal to M. I pick M to be 1. But capital F is equal to 0 on E rather than equal to a given F on E. This set is important because it measures my freedom of action. This has a lot to do with the gamma. think about the gamma. Think about two different interpolants. Suppose that F1 equals F on E, and I have some control of the norm of F1 in CM. Let's say it's less than M. And the same thing is true of F2. Well, I can then look at the difference, F1 minus F2. The jet of F1 belongs to the gamma. The jet of F2 belongs to the gamma. The difference between F1 and F2 will vanish on E, and its CM norm will be at most 2m. And therefore, the difference between two jets in the gamma will lie in 2m times the sigma. The m, if you think about it, the gamma is basically a translate of the sigma if the gamma is non-empty. Okay, so there is this sigma, and analogous to the process of finding gamma 0, gamma 1, etc., gamma sub L, in addition to that, there is a similar process. There are gamma 0 of x, gamma 1 of x, and more generally, gamma L of x, and they are defined by the same process as the sigma, as the gamma L, except that you set F equal to 0 and capital M equal to 1. Okay? So we can define these guys. And they're very important for interpolation problems because, for example, if they are very big, then we have a lot of freedom in deciding what the jet of our interpolant will be. And if they are very small, we have very little freedom in deciding what the jet of our interpolant will be. Okay? So when we assign a label, the assignment of a label to a given local interpolation problem will depend entirely on the size and shape of these guys, which we hope have to do with the size and shape of gamma, of sigma itself, although we don't know that until we've finished proving the theorem. Okay? So I will say that A, that label A, may be attached to a local interpolation problem Q E X F P if and only if the following thing happens. So let's say Q has a side length del Q. Okay? And I'm going to say for each multi-index alpha in script A, I look at the monomial and now there's a scaling factor, the side length of Q to some power. There's a correct power, don't worry about it. And then we have, let's say, Y minus X. Oh, X, I'm sorry. So for each alpha in A, and for each y in E, this monomial, so let's pick a letter of the alphabet other than X and Y, right? X is the base point, Y is this arbitrary point in E. So let's say Z goes to the scaling factor times Z minus Y to the alpha. So this monomial belongs to some constant, which constant depends on the label A, and sigma L at Y, and this L also depends on the label A. So I'm afraid that now, I want to say two things. One, this may seem messy and complicated. On the other hand, this is one of the biggest lies I'm telling you today. In order to make it simpler and less messy and complicated, I wrote this. But simply, if at each y in E, the sigma attached to y is big in certain directions on a length scale having to do with the cube Q, then I declare that it's okay to attach the label to the cube Q. how much, how many scowls do I see in response to that?
So does this label depend on the best data that Disney LIP?
This, I'm sorry, this, the label?
So this label doesn't depend on all of the data?
Okay, this, good point. This does not depend on the F or the P. It depends, or for that matter, the X. It depends only on the Q and the E. Yes. Yes. Okay? So you look at the Q and the E, and you ask something like this. I'm sorry? Well, if alpha is zero, then something. I'm sorry. Then how could this would then be the function up to some constant multiple? This would be the function one. How can that vanish on the set E? Only if the set E is empty. So whenever this label script A contains the multi-index zero, it can label a local interpolation problem only if the set E is empty. In particular, script M labels an interpolation problem only if the set E is empty. So if you look at the definition of the local interpolation problem, imagine that the set E is empty. You're simply trying to find a function whose jet at a given point is P and whose semi-norm is as small as possible. We take P. That's a polynomial. It's certainly, its semi-norm is zero, which is as small as possible, and its jet is the right thing at one point. That is a trivial problem. So among the various things I promised you, one of the easiest is why is it that script M only labels a trivial problem? Well, exactly as you point out, it can only label a problem in which you're interpolating on the empty set. Okay, so script M labels only trivial problems, which we know how to solve. Okay, now I owe you this. And it's clear if A prime is contained in A, then for A to attach to a problem, I have to find all these guys for all alpha in A. But if A prime is a subset, I only have to look at the corresponding fellows for alpha in A prime. That's a strictly easier job. I'm sorry? Monomial, sorry, the monomial. It is not actually a monomial. The actual statement is there exists a polynomial with certain properties, etc. And today, because I'm lying to you, we're going to think of it as a monomial. Yes. Then we have to. Wait. If we decrease A, let's say suppose that we have A and A prime, and A prime is a subset of A. Well, if the label A attaches, then we have all of these guys belonging to some sigma, and now we throw some of them away, and so for all alpha in A prime, these guys will still belong to this. I'm sorry. So it is easier if A prime is contained in A. It is more likely that a label A prime will attach to a given problem than it is that A will attach, but saying that A will attach to the problem gives me more information than having A prime attached to the problem. I was careful not to specify it. But as A gets bigger in the partial order, let's see. I mean, this is monotone in A with respect to the partial order. I don't instantly remember whether it's monotone increasing or. How is it chosen? Yes. It's given by some simple form. All right. Here's what I think. I've already said I'm lying to you. So here, okay. Here's what I think is true. All right. L of A is, let's say, 10 plus 3 times the number of A prime strictly less than A in the partial order. That's what I think L of A is. I would have to go back to the paper and look it up. I let me remind you, by the way, the stuff that I'm describing is joint work with Boas Klartag. Okay. let me write his name down again. Okay. And C of A grows very rapidly, and I don't remember exactly how, but it grows very rapidly with A. Okay. Yes. 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 Okay. So that's how you should think today about how we attach a label. Again, it's not really how we attach a label, but close enough for an expository lecture. Okay? Notice that if script A is the empty set, then I do not have to show you anything. There are no monomials that have to belong to the set sigma of whatever. Every local interpolation problem carries the label of the empty set vacuously because the definition is such that I don't have to produce anything. Okay? So I think now everything that I owe you is established with the slight exception of the main point. The main point is the induction hypothesis, okay? So given all of this spiel, suppose that I know how to solve all local interpolation problems that are easier than a given one. So I fix a label script A. Script A is not the most trivial one, script M. I fix my script A, and I assume that any interpolation problem that carries the label A prime for any A prime less than A, I can solve. And now I've got to solve script A. That's what remains. Yes?
Sorry.
No.
I know you answered this, but can you please remind us, so why is the base of induction trivial?
The base of induction is trivial because the only interpolation problems that carry the most trivial label have the set E being the empty set. And so you have to interpolate data on the empty set. Okay. There is still one condition, namely you have the jet. So you might wonder what... Yes. So was my X in E? Oh, my X shouldn't be in E. My X should just be in the cube. It needn't be in E. That's one of the lies I told you. I'm sorry. Otherwise, I guess there would be no problem. Yes. No, you did not miss it. I did not define it. I mean, I can define it if you like, but I promise you, this is the main property that we need to worry about right now. And if we were slogging through every detail, we would need to know what the order is. But for today, let's forget that. But I did not tell you the order. You didn't miss it. I didn't tell it. Okay. All right, at this rate, I think there is no chance in the world that I will get to infinite sets. I would propose to take a 5-minute break, and at the end of the 5 minutes, I will sketch the induction step. Okay. Okay. Yes, the recording is on, the microphone is on? Okay. All right. So, yes, so here's our local interpolation problem. This is the induction step. This is the main point that I owe you. So here is our cube. Q, not to scale, here's the bigger cube, Q star. I have my set E. I have a point. Let me use what's available here. Here's a point. This is the point, the base point X, and associated to X I have P, and on this set E I have F. So there's my problem. Now I'm going to fix a label A, and I'm going to assume that this problem. So let's call this. Let's put zeros on all these things. This is the problem I'm trying to solve. That this carries label A, but no easier label. All right. Then yes, it's going to change. It's going to see. Okay. Now, I want to solve this interpolation problem. So I'm going to proceed by a Calderon-Zygmund decomposition, as in the proof of in the classical 1934 proof of Whitney. So I'm going to take this cube Q0 and look at it, and I'm going to decide whether I'm happy. In a minute, I'll tell you what that means. All right. But I'm going to ask, am I happy with this cube? And the answer is no, because I don't know how to solve the local interpolation problem. So therefore, I'm going to cut Q into pieces like that. And now I look for each one of these. Let's say I look at that one, and I look. So I call this Q. And I look at Q star, and I cut down E by intersecting it with Q star, okay? And I pick some convenient base point in there. And I pick, so, all right, so, wait, how to organize this? Maybe I should step back and say the following. So there are going to be several steps. So we'll proceed in several steps. So what are we trying to do? We're trying to solve this local interpolation problem, and we don't know how to solve it because it isn't labeled by anything easier than A. So step one is make the right Calderon-Zygmund decomposition. So I'm not going to tell you yet what that is, but there's going to be some rule for deciding whether I'm happy with a given cube. And I start with the cube Q0, I examine it. If I'm happy with it, which I won't be, then I keep it. Otherwise, I bisect it into, in this case, 4, because I've drawn a two-dimensional picture. I look at each of the subcubes and I ask, am I happy? And if I am happy, then I keep the cube with which I'm happy, and that's one of my Calderon-Zygmund cubes. Otherwise, I bisect it. And I keep on going until I'm happy at each stage. So we make a Calderon-Zygmund decomposition of Q0 into finitely many cubes. And I owe you a description of how to do that. Finitely many subcubes. And let's call these maybe Q nu. So there are finitely many of them. Now, for each Q, for each of these Calderon-Zygmund cubes, let's pick a base point. I'm sorry? Yes, and the base, so the base point X nu should lie in Q nu star, and because I'm lying to you, sometimes this will have to belong to E and at other times it won't. Let's say at the moment all base points have to belong to E, and one of the properties of my Calderon-Zygmund decomposition is that Q nu star intersect E is always non-empty, and so I will pick X nu in there. Okay? So now I have a new base point. I define E nu to be simply E intersect Q nu star, to preserve the property that the E should be in the star of the Q. Okay? So now what have I got? I've got a cube, I've got an X, I've got an E. I can easily define F nu to be my F restricted to the E nu. Okay? And now we'll define also a jet P nu, which I'm going to think of as a jet at the base point X nu. Okay? So what have I not... these are all promises. I haven't kept them. First IOU is, what on earth is this Calderon-Zygmund decomposition? Second IOU, how do I define the jet P nu? Okay, but let me go on. Once that has happened, here maybe I can erase what a local interpolation problem is and so on, what a label is. So, note, for each nu, I've now defined enough information that I can consider the local interpolation problem that I'll call LIP sub nu, that's defined to be the local interpolation problem with data Q nu, E nu, X nu, F nu, and P nu. Okay? So my big problem is cut up into little problems. Whatever. These are the Q nu. And on each one of these, I have a local interpolation problem. Okay, now, step three. The Calderon-Zygmund decomposition in step one was chosen so that we know that each of the local interpolation problems LIP nu carries a label strictly less than A, in other words, easier than the one we're trying to do now. Okay? How do you know that? Well, it's inconceivable that you would know that until I tell you what the Calderon-Zygmund decomposition is, okay? But that's the main clue as to how to make the Calderon-Zygmund decomposition. Therefore, for each nu, we can find a local interpolant F nu defined on Q nu star. So F nu agrees with the data, it has the given jet, its norm is as small as possible to within some factor. Okay? So we have local interpolants. And now the final step is to glue the local interpolants F nu together into a global interpolant F just by using a partition of unity. Okay, so we define F to be the sum on nu of theta nu, F nu, where theta nu is the following. Here's our big cube, Q. Here's one of our little cubes, Q nu. Here's Q nu star. And theta nu, well, so theta nu is supported in here. And as smooth as possible. As smooth as possible means that if you differentiate theta nu, you lose every time you differentiate, you lose one power of the side length. So one can make a partition of unity. One is the sum Q theta nu on Q0 or on Q0 star, whatever, and each theta nu is supported in Q nu star and is as smooth as possible. Like that.
In reality, these little cubes won't necessarily cover
a Q star, right. When I said I make a Calderon-Zygmann decomposition of Q0, maybe instead I should have made a Calderon-Zygmann decomposition of Q0 star. Again, this is, you know, this is all rough and motivational, and one has to nitpick the, I mean, I promise you I've nitpicked the actual paper. Okay, so, all right. That's the plan. Now, all right, so why on earth should that work? Well, it's pretty clear that we can arrange this way to have our interpolant match the function little f. If we take a little care, we can also get the correct jet at this base point x0, because this x0 will be contained in one of these guys, and for that one, we just want to make sure that the base point that we assign to this particular, let's say this is q nu. This is the q nu in which the pink dot appears. Okay. And what part of what we did was to pick a base point in each of the Q nu. In this Q nu, we pick our base point to be that base point, the pink dot. And we've guaranteed to have the right jet at each base point of the little guys. Therefore, we will have the correct jet at the base point, I mean at the pink dot. So getting the interpolant to agree with the function little f and the jet p is not a problem. What is a problem is getting the norm to be as small as possible. Okay. Now, we either do or do not have the slightest chance for this to succeed, depending on how we picked the p sub nu. Just consider a partition of unity like this one, where these theta nus are supported in the doubles of little tiny cubes. It's clear that you can take very nice smooth functions and put them together by a partition of unity, but the awfulness of the partition of unity will cause the blended together function to be just awful. So we could be just out of luck. In order for this program to have a chance, we need to make sure that these p nu are picked in order to be mutually consistent. If two little cubes, q nu and q nu prime, are very close, their p nu and p nu prime had better also be very close. Otherwise, there's no chance. All right. All right. So the toughest problem in this whole business is to arrange that. Okay. All right, so, all right, what remains? Well, let me tell you what the Calderon-Zeigman decomposition is. Then let me explain how we find these P nu and how that ties up with the definition of the gamma L. Remember, I'm supposed to be proving a theorem about the gamma L, and their definition, I mean, their definition has barely appeared in the discussion. Okay. So, all right, first of all, what is the Calderon-Zeigman decomposition? So given a cube, how do I decide whether it's happy? It's very simple. I simply look at the local interpolation problem, lip nu, and I ask whether it carries a label strictly less than A. If so, I declare that I'm happy, and otherwise I'm unhappy and keep cutting. That's almost true. There's one other way I can be happy. I can be happy if my cube is so small that, let's say, Q star contains at most one point of E. You know, the general interpolation problems may be hard, but interpolation problems involving sets E that consist of at most one point are not very hard. So I declare that I'm happy if either Q is so small that that Q star contains at most one point of E, or if this localized problem carries a label strictly less than A. Now, of course, this is a potential problem because in step one, I made the Calderon-Zeigman decomposition, and in step two, I introduced the P nu, and that clearly depends on the Calderon-Zeigman decomposition, and so I had better not make use of P nu in the Calderon-Zeigman rule. So this looks bad, but Ed's question exactly answers this point, because remember, in deciding whether a given problem carries a given label, I don't use all the data. I only use the Q and the E. I don't use the X, the F, or the P. In particular, I don't use P nu, which I haven't defined yet. So this Calderon-Zeigman rule makes sense. The Calderon-Zeigman rule clearly partitions Q into at most finitely many Q subcubes, because at some point, if I manage to get down to a really, really tiny cube, because the set E is finite, at some point I will notice that Q star contains at most one point of the set E, and then I will stop. So this machine does not grind on forever without doing anything. Rather, it actually produces a partition of Q into finitely many subcubes. Okay. All right. So that's the description. I mean, that's how the Calderon-Zeigman decomposition works. So that's true. It's now abundantly clear that So I promised you that the Calderon-Zeigman decomposition in step one was chosen so that each of these local problems carries a label less than A. Well, that's not quite true. It carries a label less than A, or we're interpolating at most one point. So in any event, we know how to solve each of the local interpolation problems, the non-trivial ones by induction, the trivial ones because they're trivial. Okay. Finally, what else then do I owe you? And the answer is I have to tell you how to define the P nu in order to obtain the desired local consistency. Once I do that, then this method of proof has a chance. I haven't proven to you that it works, but at least I hope it's intuitive that it's not guaranteed to fail. So let me explain how that's done. So in fact, in my local interpolation problem, I actually want to make sure. I want to make sure that when I specify my P, that it belongs to gamma of X M for some suitable M. Otherwise, there's no chance. Right? If I'm trying to, well, so let's say I actually know this. Maybe this is some constant of A times M. So I would like to introduce this into the game. Now, why is this true? Well, I could say to you, you know what, this proof has been oversimplified massively, and at some point I decided not to tell you that this is a hypothesis. Or I could do the following. All right, this proof has been oversimplified massively, but never mind. I want to find an interpolant whose norm is as small as possible, and I cannot take M any smaller than this, for obvious reasons. Right? I know that if I can make an interpolant with this norm, then the jet at X of that interpolant has to lie in this gamma. So I could say that this defines M. If M is large enough, this will be true. And I take the smallest M for which this is true, for example. Okay? So in any event, I can assume this as part of the game. So here I am. I've got my great big cube, Q0. Let me ignore now the distinction between a cube and a cube Q and Q star. That's the least of our problems. All right. So here's Q0, and here is the base point X0. Where was it? It was down here in the corner someplace. So this is the base point X0. And here is some cube Q nu. And here is a base point X nu sitting inside Q nu. Okay? And I have my polynomial P0. I guess everything for the original problem had a superscript 0. P0 is in gamma L of A at X0 with, let's say, C of A M. And now I am supposed to produce for you a polynomial P nu, which is there. I have 2 minutes. It's just barely enough. Okay? So, all right. Let's see. So how to produce the P0? Well, remember, by definition of the inductive procedure, okay, there exists a P nu prime in gamma L of A minus 1 times X nu, of X nu and, let's say, C times C of A M, such that some estimates hold D alpha of P minus P nu prime of X, let's say, is less than or equal to some constant, maybe it depends on A, times M times X minus X nu to the M minus alpha. That was the defining condition for the induction step to get from the gamma L of A minus 1 to the gamma L of A, with this X nu playing the role of the Y. So there exists such a thing. So to first approximation, what I do is just pick one. Now, that's not quite true. It has to satisfy this and extra conditions having to do with the label A. That I don't have, I'm out of time. I have one more minute. Let me just wrap it up. So at least I think this shows you that the main thing that I owe you from this, which is how to pick the P nu, it at least brings into the discussion the objects about which I'm allegedly proving theorems, okay, namely the gammas, and the gamma L's in particular. So if I have enough good information about the gamma L's, I can use them this way to produce interpolants and therefore relate the gamma L's to the gammas. What I need for the induction is that this should be in gamma L of A prime for some A prime less than A. Therefore I better make sure that L of A minus 1 is greater than or equal to L of A prime for A prime less than A. But I have a lot of freedom to pick this function, and so I pick it so that this is true. All right. I think I should stop. It's now, I mean, if you have the feeling of understanding something, I'm delighted. Of course, this is not the proof. This is something sort of free associated to the proof to give, you know, to give the right point of view. Okay, thank you. There is more or less what I wrote here, and yes, it is written down. I think it is on my website. I will look it up, and I'm happy to email the correct thing to look at. There is a semi-expository version of this thing written down. It doesn't have, I think it doesn't have significantly more detail than I just spoke, but it doesn't have significantly less either.